It is Monday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, thousands flee Kirkuk as Iraqi forces advance on the city. Results from Austria's election indicate the country is turning right.
Immigration was the issue, and this was the consequence of the Syrian crisis.
And guitarist Joe Walsh works to help America's military veterans. It's all ahead. Iraqi forces have captured a key airbase north of the city of Kirkuk, along with positions to the south, following a call by Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to reclaim control of the disputed area from Kurdish forces. Kurds have controlled Kirkuk city since pushing out Islamic State fighters who swept into Iraq in 2014 and have long disagreed with the central government over who should control areas in the surrounding province, including its oil fields. Tensions rose further 3 weeks ago when the government of the semi-autonomous Kurdish region held an independence referendum that was overwhelmingly approved by those who voted. I spoke with VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, who visited the outskirts of Kirkuk Monday.
Well, the fighting began early this morning, and by the time I got to Kirkuk this afternoon, I was just on the outskirts because the road in had been cut, and the road, by the time I got there, the road out had been cut as well. However, it wasn't like the fight. The fighting has spread. We were actually probably about 7 kilometers from the center of the city, and the mortars were falling at that point. It was one of the last points controlled by Kurdish Peshmerga forces. We left. We were there briefly, but we left after the volunteer soldiers, not regular Peshmerga soldiers, told us that there was sniper fire coming, and they could see two cars that belonged to the popular mobilization unit, they call them here, Heshabi, coming their way. And so people at that point, everyone scattered and moved back. I don't know what happened after that because they were supposed to get out of that area very fast. But it does appear that the forces from Baghdad are taking more and more of Kirkuk quite rapidly. But I've also heard that there's still fighting going on inside. And we call families that are still there. They say they're not going outside at all because they're afraid of bombs, sniper fire. My friend was hearing heavy artillery. Some soldiers said that they even saw an airstrike.
So you have been speaking with civilians. I mean, I guess they probably some want to leave, but some are frightened to do so because of the fighting and bombs going off.
Yes. This morning and this afternoon, all throughout most of the afternoon, there were people were leaving Kirkuk as fast as they could. I know someone who left this morning, and he said it took him 3 hours to get out of the city around 11:30 this morning in a trip that would normally take 10 minutes to get from where he was to the outskirts of the city. That's how bad the traffic was. And the traffic between Kirkuk and Erbil has been packed all day long with people fleeing Kirkuk. But now, as I was saying before, it's closed, and some of the civilian guards on the perimeters are saying people are trapped inside. People who want to get out can't at this point. The other road, we've heard, the road to Baghdad is also closed. And then on the road to Salamiya, another Kurdish city, has been closed over dispute between within the Kurdish regional government.
Now, I believe that you spoke to a Peshmerga soldier, and he was mm-hmm. describing to you the situation he's confronting. What did he tell you?
Well, the Peshmerga soldiers we talked to said that they're still holding some of Kirkuk, and they're fighting. Their enemy is only holding part of the city. They say, though, they are vastly outgunned, that the popular mobilization unit has better weapons and more support. They have had a really rough time. They say that they've taken many casualties, both deaths and injuries, that haven't given any details. I'm sure it's far too soon to count. They're also telling tales about violence going on in the streets as well and among the families. But I think if that was the case, it was only happening early on in the conflict because other people coming out have said that they are not, neither party is at this point or at any point targeting civilians.
VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, Sarah, fallout from the sexual assault claims against Hollywood mega producer Harvey Weinstein continue on social media. Over the weekend, we saw actress Alyssa Milano posted a note on her social media accounts that said, "If all the women who have been sexually harassed or assaulted wrote Me Too as a status, we might give people a sense of the magnitude of this problem." And all through the weekend and into today, we've seen messages popping up on Twitter and in Facebook news feeds as women, as well as some men, share that they've faced sexual harassment or abuse. We're seeing a lot of people putting that Me Too up there and encouraging others who have faced that abuse to put that up as well. Some are using this as a chance just to reveal the news and share their stories, including a number of celebrities who have been targeted by Weinstein or other producers or powerful people in Hollywood. Others are noting that this is a social media campaign that has stretched among people's friends and family. It shows how pervasive this problem is and that it's not limited to Hollywood. And then there are those that are wondering, it's one thing to speak up, but how can we stop this? What can be done to stop this? Now, that brings us to our other trending story today, which is a follow-up from something we talked about last week. We talked about how actress Rose McGowan had her Twitter account suspended after she tweeted about the sexual assault claims against Weinstein and how actor Ben Affleck allegedly helped to cover that up. Well, McGowan's suspension prompted outrage and a 24-hour Twitter boycott by women. After that instance, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey said that the social network will be implementing new rules in the coming weeks to address sexual harassment and a host of other harmful tweets and practices on Twitter. So he wrote in a series of tweets, Jack Dorsey, "Today," referring to Friday, "we saw voices silencing themselves and voices speaking out because we're still not doing enough. We've been working intensely over the past few months and focused today on making some critical decisions. We decided to take a more aggressive stance in our rules and how we enforce them." So Twitter will be coming out with new rules to address everything from unwanted sexual advances, non-consensual nudity, hate symbols, violent groups, and tweets that glorify violence. So not just looking at the issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault, but creating a broader scope to address a lot of the things that people have been talking about going on in social media that need to be stopped.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot out there.
Yes.
All right, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The death toll tops 300 from the weekend's blast in Mogadishu. U.S. green card lottery applications have been lost and must be resubmitted. A U.S. soldier, Bo Berdahl, pleads guilty to desertion, misbehavior before the enemy, and Rohingya children drown while fleeing Myanmar's Rakhine State. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have determined that Saturn's largest moon, Titan, has a hydrological cycle similar to Earth. While Earth's cycle involves the circulation of water between land, sea, and atmosphere, on Titan, it's liquid methane that cycles this way. A new computer model-based study by researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, suggests that powerful monsoon-like storms of methane pummel Titan's surface. Although the storms were found to take place less than once each Titan year, which is 29 and a half Earth years, the models show that the storms dump at least 30 centimeters of liquid methane a day, creating massive floods in terrain that is usually desert-like. The researchers say their findings could help provide scientists with new insights into the effect that climate change has not only on Earth, but on other planets as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a media rights group comments on President Trump's suggestion that the government should allocate broadcast licenses. Austria's People's Party emerged the winner from Sunday's election with 31-year-old foreign minister Sebastian Kurz on track to be Europe's youngest leader. But he will have to form a coalition government. The right-wing Freedom Party made gains, but was in close contest with the Social Democrats for second place.
Der heutige Tag ist ein historischer. Der heutige Tag ist unsere Chance.
Kurz called the outcome historic. It is our chance, he said, to take the leadership and carry out real change. That change is likely to include tightened immigration controls following the influx of more than 1 million refugees from South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. Natalie Doyle, a senior lecturer at Australia's Monash University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the result is part of a trend underway in Europe for a while.
The left is really on the back foot. It started in the Netherlands. It also became very obvious in the French elections, and the Austrian election confirms that the Austrian Socialist Party is in trouble. It was also apparent, I may add, in Germany. The only exception to that is the United Kingdom, where the Labour Party seems to have gained new life.
And why do you think this trend is underway?
In the case of Austria and Germany, the situation is slightly different because the left, in fact, was in open political government coalitions. They were not in the opposition. So, in a sense, the Austrian result is a rejection of those grand coalitions. But the fact is that in other countries, even though the parties, the socialist parties or the social democratic parties, depending on their terminology, were, in fact, very much part of a governing consensus, even if they were not in actual coalitions. And the electorates are basically rejecting the left because they feel that it's not that different from the right.
Was immigration a major issue in this campaign?
Immigration was the issue, and this was the consequence of the Syrian crisis and the decisions made by Angela Merkel and pretty much imposed on the rest of European Union members to, in fact, allow in all the refugees and to try and pressure countries to accept a quota of refugees right across Europe. Kurz is, in fact, been a big critic of Angela Merkel's, some would say, generous attitude towards refugees, her commitment to the humanitarian cause. He, in fact, said that it was really not acceptable because it was putting pressure on welfare benefits. And certainly during the crisis, he sort of touched upon themes which were normally the preserves of the extreme right, Austrian identity, Islamization. The problem was particularly acute for Austria because it is, in fact, doing very well economically. So there was a kind of push within the immigrant population to try and make it to Austria through the Balkans. And Kurz claims, I don't know if that's true, that he played a big role in actually pressuring the European Union, and that means other countries in the European Union, such as just Hungary, to actually cut down the Balkan path, the path taken by immigrants towards Austria.
Natalie Doyle says as fear of more terrorist attacks and the Islamization of Europe rises along with nationalist sentiment, leaders like French President Emmanuel Macron stand to lose support for the European Union concept of free movement of peoples across the continent. Last week, President Trump threatened to use the federal government's power to pull the TV license of the National Broadcasting Corporation in response to a report by the network's news division that he suggested a huge expansion of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. NBC said Trump's comments on the size of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, now at about 4,000 weapons, came up at a Pentagon meeting with top military and national security officials in July. The network cited the recollections of three people who were there. The network said Trump indicated he wanted a bigger arsenal. President Trump has denied that report. Alex Ellerbeck is the North America Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, a New York-based media rights organization. She tells me her group's reaction to Trump's threat.
The Committee to Protect Journalists is a global organization, so we look at threats around the world. And this is not the first time that we've seen leaders threaten to news outlets' licenses based on their coverage. This is something we've seen in Russia, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. The fact that President Donald Trump has put himself in this company, in the company of authoritarian leaders, is very concerning to us.
For an American president to do this, I think years ago President Richard Nixon made a similar threat, but I don't think he did it publicly.
No, But you're right. It is behavior that we saw under the Nixon administration. He had some of his political allies challenge licenses of Washington Post-owned television stations in Florida. And while those challenges weren't ultimately successful, they did cause serious problems and costs to the stations and to the Washington Post.
Now, in the United States, the freedom of the press is guaranteed by the Constitution. However, is a network like NBC that is, however, regulated by the government?
It is, and the president is responsible for nominating FCC commissioners and selecting the chairperson. That said, the FCC is an independent agency, and I think the threat is ultimately an empty one. It's incredibly, incredibly rare for a station to lose its license. And it's worth pointing out that the FCC doesn't even license a network like NBC. Instead, they license individual television stations, which may include ones owned by Comcast or affiliates that air NBC programming.
And what about cable channels, such as news channels like CNN or Fox News or MSNBC?
They don't license those. And there was even a point where the current chairman, Ajit Pai, commented regarding people on Twitter who regularly demand that FCC yank licenses from cable news channels. And he said, setting aside the fact that FCC doesn't license cable channels, these demands are fundamentally at odds with our legal and cultural traditions. Now, he hasn't weighed in about Trump's direct threats, but like I said, I really think for now these are empty threats in the sense that I don't think NBC's licensing is at immediate risk. But to the extent that this shows the level of intimidation and bullying that the U.S. president is willing to go to suppress speech he doesn't like, it is a very real threat. And the example it sends to the world is extremely concerning.
Alex Ellerbeck, North America Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world, and you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The nation's official recognition of America's veterans annually on November 11th, Veterans Day, got an early start this year with a star-studded concert kicking off a new fundraising movement for organizations that help the men and women who served in uniform. David Byrd tells us about Vets Aid.
Joe Walsh is best known as a guitarist, both with the James Gang and later with the Eagles. But he is also the son of a military flight instructor who died while on active duty in Japan. Walsh says that because of his family history and his previous work with wounded veterans, he decided to start Vets Aid along the lines of the Farm Aid concerts started by country singer Willie Nelson.
We're at war. This is an ongoing war with no end in sight. And the transition back to civilian life is almost too big of a mountain to climb. Four times as many people are injured than actually killed. And I just decided that I can do something about it to help.
Walsh recruited what he called his guitar army, including blues phenom Gary Clark Jr., Keith Urban, and the Zac Brown Band.
Something wrong been going on.
Clark started the nearly four-hour concert with some of his hits, including Next Door Neighbor Blues and a cover of Come Together by the Beatles. Keith Urban had the crowd on its feet with his set, including Sweet Thing, Blue Ain't Your Color, and Wasted Time. The Zac Brown Band covered two guitar anthems in their set, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, and The Devil Went Down to Georgia by the Charlie Daniels Band. Then Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, herself a combat-wounded veteran from Iraq, came on stage to urge the nearly 7,500 fans to support Vets Aid and to help Joe Walsh help veterans.
So tonight, I'm so grateful for my friend Joe Walsh, and I'm proud to introduce him. I'd also like you to join me in dedicating tonight's performance to the memory of his father, Lieutenant Robert Newton Fiddler.
The 69-year-old Walsh played several of his hits, including Funk No. 49, Life's Been Good, Rocky Mountain Way, and In the City. Joe Walsh says he hopes the concert is the first of many to help smaller organizations that work directly with veterans.
Our guys are coming home shattered. It's like a forgotten war over here. You don't see it on the news or anything. But we are at war. Raising the public awareness so that we all start to help vets is my goal.
All the proceeds from the concert go to help veterans organizations. Walsh says he thinks the effort is off to a good start, and he's hopeful that it will grow.
Thanks to all you vets.
In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thank you, David. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As of October 12th, Sudan will no longer be subject to 20-year-old U.S. economic and trade sanctions. The United States decided to lift certain sanctions with respect to Sudan and the government of Sudan in recognition of Sudan's sustained positive actions in five key areas. First, the government of Sudan has maintained a cessation of hostilities in Darfur and the states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile. Second, it has improved humanitarian access across Sudan. Third, it has refrained from destabilizing activity in South Sudan. Fourth, it deepened its counterterrorism cooperation with the United States. And fifth, it has improved regional security by taking steps to counter Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. In an official statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert noted that the government of Sudan's actions during the last 9 months show that it is serious about cooperating with the United States. However, much more progress is needed to achieve a lasting peace in Sudan and to cooperate with the United States on a range of priorities. These priorities include, among others, expanding humanitarian access, improving Sudan's human rights and religious freedom practices, and ensuring that the government ends its relationship with North Korea, to include ensuring full implementation and enforcement of UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea. According to a senior administration official, Sudan has pledged not to pursue or continue with any arms deals with the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un. We will be closely monitoring the situation, and they understand that we have zero tolerance for continued arms deals with North Korea, the official noted. Despite the easing of sanctions, Sudan remains on the U.S. State Sponsors of Terrorism list. It also remains subject to U.S. and United Nations Security Council resolutions related to the conflict in Darfur, for which Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, faces international criminal prosecution on charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The U.S. position remains unchanged on this issue. We continue to call for all those responsible for crimes in Darfur to be held accountable, said a State Department official. The United States, said spokesperson Nauert, is prepared to use additional tools to apply pressure if the government of Sudan regresses on progress in the five areas noted above, or takes negative actions on other areas of concern.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.